Charles Darwin. He was right. No, not about the theory of evolution. That's crazy stuff. If it were cheese, it would be called Swiss, his theory on evolution. You know, there's a lot of scientific discoveries that have been disputed, and a lot of ideas about science and medicine that have been disputed for hundreds of years. They used to think, for instance, that bad blood was one of the reasons people were ill. So it was pretty common a couple of hundred years ago, maybe 300 years ago, to put leeches on people to suck out that bad blood. And eventually that one was eradicated. And I don't know when they started using leeches, but Charles Darwin's theory of evolution in the early 1800s has kind of stood the test of time in terms of the acceptance level in people's minds. You know it's wrong. I mean, you know it's wrong. That was a test question for me, by the way, when I was beginning to attend church. Do you reject the theory of evolution? Yes. I didn't know it was a thing then. That was truly when I was being interviewed or counseled to come to church services. That was one of the things that was a test question. My brother had prepared me for it, so I was ready to denounce it. I guess I didn't really ever agree or disagree with it, but okay, if it means that's what it takes to get to church, Darwin was wrong. But the theory of evolution is should have been discredited, but it feeds into other ideas of man, and so it just has hung around and hung around and hung around. And it could be easily blasted from a scientific, factual standpoint. But here we are, 21st century. That idea is still accepted by and large. In the last few weeks in the United States, we have witnessed a series of rebellions that has a source that has been unprecedented, easy for me to say, in our history in the United States. Rebellions and not even protests. Peaceful protests are not when people, by the way, to the news media, peaceful protests aren't when people throw a brick through a window and bash somebody over the head with a baseball bat. That's not considered peaceful. Just an alert to the news media. But the leaders of the various radical movements have the avowed purpose of burning our society to the ground. Now, I think a lot of their stuff is kind of accentuated by the media. There's not nearly as many of them as it appears to be. But where did they get their ideas? Where did these Chaz people get all of their crazy ideas? My purpose today is to show the origin of the ideas that are being espoused in our society. They go back many, many years, longer ago than Darwin's theory. Maybe talk a little bit about some of the authors of these crazy notions, and then finish up with showing the ideas and the actions that will change this world. And that's what we need now. We need to be reinforced that there are going to be ideas that are actually going to refute those things and replace them eventually. So how did we get here, and where are we going? Pretty simple, right? The title is The Ideas and Actions That Will Change the World. But before I can get to all of that, you have to understand how we got here in the first place. This is one of the strangest times in our history. Now, I've only lived for 67 years, but I have a little bit of a context, like most of you, in terms of the experience that we share and that we have gone through. If you're a little bit younger, if you're a lot younger, you don't really have that much experience, but hopefully you've learned from your parents and you've kind of absorbed some of the things of their history through kind of an osmosis of ideas that kind of has saturated through you from the time that you were sitting around a dinner table listening to them talk. But we have a segment of our society who are actually aligned against everything that this country was founded on. And we see a growing acceptance of ideas that we laughed at when I was kids, when we were kids, when all of us were kids. We were laughing at socialism. We were condemning communism. But a growing segment of our population today in this country is actually turning on to those false ideas. Now, if you nodded off in European history, or if they even taught it, but I'd like to think that maybe some of you were nodding off in European history, don't worry, I've got your back today. You forget all of that that you learned, because you're going to have enough here today. And I'll explain it for you. We'll cover everything you need to know here. You don't have to go back into the history books. But like Darwin, there were a number of philosophies and philosophers of the 16th, well, going back even to the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries that shaped European thought of the 19th and the 20th centuries, and many of the isms that have actually guided people and nations sprang from the thoughts and the ideas that were generated by a pack of nuts. Really, that's what they were. And when you examine their lives, you'll see what I mean. We're not going to go through all of them today, but here's an interesting fact. Even though Darwin, Charles Darwin, his name leaps off everybody's lips when the theory of evolution is mentioned, he really wasn't the originator of the idea at all. It goes back to ancient times. I won't get into that, but it goes back to the philosopher Epicurus, a Greek philosopher. That's where the idea of evolution originally sprang. So it's thousands of years old, not just even a couple of hundred. But Darwin followed up his book, and I remember reading this in biology class or, you know, some kind of history class. Darwin wrote The Origin of the Species, and that's where this cockamamie crazy idea of evolution was first published, you know, for the modern world. That was 1871, he followed it up with another book that is really kind of one of the bases of modern thought. It was called The Descent of Man. Now, that's an uplifting title, right? The Descent of Man? Yeah, he was actually one of the ones who was responsible for man's descent, if you will. In this work, Darwin pontificated, and I quote, "As many more individuals of each species are born than can possibly survive, and as consequently there is frequently reoccurring struggle for existence, it follows that," notice this, here's the emphasis, "any being, if it vary however slightly in any manner profitable to itself, under the complex and sometimes varying conditions of life, will have a better chance of surviving and thus be naturally selected. From the strong principle of inheritance, and selected variety will tend to propagate its new and modified form." Now, we can shorten all that up into one little simple phrase. You know what it is. Survival of the fittest. What Darwin suggested in his book is that the strong survive and they live to breed more like themselves. The strong breed, they survive more, the weak are bred out. Now, as pervasive as the theory of evolution has become, and the science is so outdated, 160 years later, it's still going strong, and it's crazy, right? An even more pernicious idea was launched with the Descent of Man, and that was the idea that became known as eugenics. So if it's meant that the strong survive and that the species is actually going to be greater, and you're not going to just apply it to animals when you're breeding, but what if you applied that to human beings? Now, a funny tagline that I've used from time to time when it is totally out of context, I'll say, and this brings us to Hitler. But in this case, it's not a joke. That was his whole modus operandi. And I've joked that the cab ride back from the 1936 Olympics with Hitler must have been kind of interesting. You know, if the cabbie was a talkative guy, you know. Führer, how's that survival of the fittest going? Who won the 100-yard dash and the 200-yard dash and the 400-meter dash or 400-yard, whatever the meters to yards? Who did? What was this guy's name? Jesse Owens? How's that working out for you? Eugenics is the science of improving a human population by controlled breeding to increase the occurrence of desirable heritable characteristics. It was actually developed by the uncle of Charles Darwin, and his name is Francis Galton. If you want to look up some of these names, I wouldn't spend a whole lot of time with these guys and looking in Wikipedia and everything. It's going to make you quite disturbed. It's going to make you angry as a member of the Church of God and somebody that believes in values and somebody that believes in law and somebody that believes in creation. So don't spend too much time with these guys, because maybe that's the reason you kind of nodded off in history class. I don't know. Turn to Colossians chapter 2 and verse 8. Francis Galton, G-A-L-T-O-N, was the cousin, pardon me, not the uncle, he was the cousin of Charles Darwin, and he's the one that popularized the idea of selective breedings of human beings in 1865. You know, isn't it interesting? The descendants of Abraham, both the British Commonwealth and the United States of America, had by that time rejected slavery. By that time, the two most civilized nations on the face of the earth, who became the richest nations on the face of the earth, had rejected slavery. The Brits did it in the early 1800s, and we had a war about it and went to war, and we solved the issue, and we got rid of it, and we denied that it was something that we should have ever been a part of, and we solved that problem. And here is this guy, this European, this Francis Galton, I guess he was British, who reintroduced the idea of selective breeding. You know, what a crazy nut. And then Darwin absorbed his information as his cousin and later on wrote his stupid book. But doing that to inject a little humor, a little colloquial humor. Colossians chapter 2 and verse 8, they didn't have these problems back in the first century A.D., but the general idea is the same. Man comes up with his philosophies apart from men. The Greeks came up with their apart from God. The Greeks came up with all of their philosophies apart from any influence from God. And Paul said, beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit. You're cheated if you believe in this nonsense. According to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world and not according to Christ. Christianity began to spread through the Roman Empire, and it revolutionized a lot of different ideas, a lot of false and pagan ideas. And as soon as it began to take hold, it was attacked by these false isms of man. So man came up with a bunch of different ideas, and in the 15th, 16th, 17th, and 18th century, they were just ideas. Here's a book that will kind of, at least the title, will make you laugh a little bit. It's called 10 Books That Screwed Up the World. And the subtitle is, and 5 Others That Didn't Help. And the author, Benjamin Wicker, quotes a Scot. You know, every sermon I give, I should quote a Scot, shouldn't I? Okay. Thomas Carlyle. He was at in the 19th century, he was at a dinner party. And he was talking about all the crazy books that had been written in man's history and up until that time. And some lady at the party said, Mr. Carlyle, these are just ideas, nothing but ideas. And he said back to her, he said, there was once a man called Rousseau who wrote a book containing nothing but ideas. The second edition was bound in the skins of those who laughed at the first. It was the ideas of Rousseau that inspired one of the bloodiest revolutions in history, the French Revolution. You know, it was a crazy time, and one of their great inventions was the guillotine, and eventually, you know, everybody was being guillotined because of Rousseau's ideas that were, you know, just thought of as mere platitudes. Now, a couple of years ago, actually 3 years ago, do you remember the Christian world celebrated the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation? 500 years old. What has the Protestant Reformation really done for mankind? Not a whole lot, really, when you get down to it. No great theological ideas that changed human behavior. But in 1450, Johannes Gutenberg invented movable type, and it was the forerunner of the modern printing press. And the first thing that became available through the printing press was the Bible. And the Bible then began to be read, and it was accessible to virtually everybody that could get a hold of a book. It wasn't closeted away in some church away from the people. But, and this sounds strange to us living in the 20th century where this is the bestseller year after year after year in most every language now. But back then, they didn't have it available to read and to study like we do. But in 1450, when it came about and there was greater access to the Bible, it revolutionized the world. But of course, every time God's ideas are presented, there's the other falsehoods and isms that come around. And that's when the beginning also was of man's rebirth of philosophy and all of the classical ideas that sprang up. And guess what? They were also published to the world. So you've heard the names of, I don't know if you want to take these down, but you can just look up Wikipedia, worldly philosophers, and you'll find them. But here are the names: Machiavelli, Hobbes, Descartes, Rousseau, Marx, of course, Engels, Mills, Darwin, Nietzsche, Lenin, then even Hitler, Sanger, the 20th century, Sanger, Freud, Kinsey, Frieden. All of these ideas, you could just throw them in a bag, shake them all up. They're all the same, really, in some of their basic components. For the past 500 years, these people have probably had greater effect than one of the greatest of all theological events, at least in man's view, the Protestant Reformation. Because the ideas of these authors, who then began to be printed just along with the Bible and read, you know, they kind of started to germinate in the European universities in the 19th century. They began to be read in Europe. In Europe, these books began to be read more than the Bible did by the 19th century. In our nation, it was different. People noticed the difference in our nation. The Bible was the foundation of our Constitution. It was the ideas of liberty, which come from the Bible, individual liberty found in the first five books of the Bible. That's the way society ought to be. Our guest last week, Doug Young, was posing the question, you know, what do you think government is going to be like in the world tomorrow, in the 1,000 years? We kind of talked about it, and he offered the idea. He says, you know, I think it's kind of be, you know, more self-regulated. I said, absolutely, because there's so much that has been a part of our society that has been kind of self-regulation. And we know that it's been imperfect, but just think, if one of the Ten Commandments were universally obeyed by everybody, leave all the rest of the nine out, what a change there would be. And that one area would be significant if everybody did it. Now, law keeps our society together. What we have seen in some of these areas today where people don't really respect the law is the opposite. It's anarchy. It's what was espoused by these nuts who were smart. They were just smart nuts, smart, crazy intellectuals. So these ideas began to be read and they began to be studied. They began to be taught through the universities of Europe. And what happened in the 20th century? Mankind was almost brought to extinction during those years. In fact, survival of the fittest was probably the idea that brought about World War I and World War II. The strong survive. It's estimated that over 80 million people died in the world in World War II. 80 million. Now, communism in its various iterations and overthrows all throughout the world was responsible, and these aren't the figures I cooked up, by the way. They come from reputable sources. Responsible for 94 million deaths in the 20th century. Now, Stalin killed 20 million people of his own Russian people. And in this nation, we know that well over 60 million lives have been systematically jettisoned even before birth, just since the decision by the Supreme Court in 1972, Roe versus Wade, which legalized murder for the unborn. And that is more than the combined population of Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, North and South Carolina, and Georgia. It's shocking, isn't it? It really is. It's amazing. But where did the idea for abortion come from? These nuts. A nut in the early 1920s by the name of Margaret Sanger. She is the founder of what became Planned Parenthood, or as I would like to call it, just planned abortion. She is, in that sense, this is the irony, she is the mother of this modern movement. It's estimated that in the 20th century, just as a result of war, over 260 million people were killed. So that's the result of man's ideas and philosophies. And the only thing that really stopped a lot of that from being much worse, and I don't care if this sounds racist or not, it was the descendants of Abraham. It was the British peoples and the United States that prevented it from being worse. Were it not for the descendants of Abraham and the blessings they brought to the world, these combined philosophies would have a much worse effect than they did. Notice Micah chapter 5 and verse 7. This is a prophecy, actually. This is a Bible prophecy that shows the interventional ability of the people who came from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. Now, while you're turning to Micah 5 and verse 7, do you know that contrary to popular opinion, this is pointed out by my good friend Melvin Rhodes in one of his essays, the British Commonwealth of Nations was a group that before and just after World War II, nations in Africa wanted to become a part of. And one of the stipulations of becoming a member nation of the British Commonwealth of Nations, they had them on a wait list, kind of like we're going to have for the feast. You know, you register for Tucson, we're going to put you on a wait list. There's a wait list for nations that wanted to become a part of the British Commonwealth of Nations. And one of the stipulations was that they had to repudiate and outlaw slavery. And now you hear a member of the British Crown repudiating the idea that the British Commonwealth did any good in Africa. What a farce. another person that nodded off in history class. Micah 5 and verse 7. Then the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many peoples. Remnant means descendant. Like dew from the Lord, like showers of the grass that tarry for no man nor wait for the sons of men. And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the Gentiles in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among flocks of sheep, who if he passes through both treads down and tears in pieces and none can deliver. Your hand shall be lifted against your adversaries, and all your enemies shall be cut off. During the time of Micah, the nation of Israel was on the descent for sure. They would no longer be powerful. Micah was inspired to speak of the future, to speak of what would happen in the 20th century, and we know that we can point to that time and know that it happened. At the beginning of the 19th century, Great Britain and the United States began to dominate the world scene like no other nations have ever done, even since ancient Rome. And they held in check the power of the vain philosophies of men. Now, other prophecies show that Ephraim would be sick, and he did become sick, and they have left many of the values of the Bible, and their churches aren't strong any longer. None of their churches. Religion is was kind of cast off. They were closer to Europe. They were closer. They had, you know, I mean, Marx, Engels, they're born there. I mean, they had more of these philosophical, nutty ideas coursing through their educational system. But it's the ideas and the philosophies of the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th century that wreaked havoc on mankind. And if it weren't for the modern descendants of Israel, this world would be in really bad shape. Now, you're not going to hear that from all the nuttiness that is going on today, and even from some of the highest elected officials who have denied that there's really anything unique about the American experience. What a shame. What a tragedy. We didn't exactly know this would all come down exactly in the way that it has, but nonetheless, it is happening. We're living through it. When you examine the lives of these dominant philosophers, I named their names, there's one common theme among all of them. None of them really believed in a supreme God. They came up with all of these ideas to explain life apart from God's revelation, apart from God's creation. Proverbs 29 and verse 18 says, their lives, the lives of all those they influenced, all of that is found here. This is a prophecy of itself. Proverbs 29 and verse 18, where there is no revelation, the people cast off restraint. And of course, that's happened in our society too, right? That happened through the turbulent 60s and people, you know, began to rebel against authority and against institutions and against law. Happy is he who keeps the law. Society is generally much happier when they obey the law. Having rejected God in the Bible and all revelation, all the philosophies of man lead to self-determination. And look what it's brought us to. Craziness, and it's happening in this nation now. Same ideas. Now, there's this group of people still in our nation who believe in the foundation of law. They believe in the foundation of the country. They believe in the Constitution. But you'd think that the majority of thought was in rebellion to all of that. That's the power of the media. That is the power of the media. They hold the megaphone. They're pumping out this information 24/7. I don't know what's going to happen in the fall. I guess nothing would surprise me. I'm optimistic because it's very difficult to envision the ability to preach the gospel. You know, it's only been in the last few years to where churches weren't held to this standard that they couldn't ever comment about anything political. Because we were constantly lectured about that throughout the 80s and the 90s in the ministry. I don't know if you remember this, Mr. Horchak, but we were told, hey, you can't make political comments from the lectern. There's a separation of church and state, blah, blah, blah. Well, is some law, you know, some, it wasn't even a law. It was some ruling by something somewhere by somebody. And all I know is that the president eliminated that. No, we're not going to, no, just executive order, whatever. Churches aren't prohibited from making political, what would be considered political statements. Because when it comes down to it, political, a political statement is really kind of in the eyes of the beholder. It'd be what, you know, what this person wants to that might be in power that says you can't do this. Now, if he's not reelected, then that all is going bye-bye. And so the Church of God has had to go underground at various times. We'll see what happens. But Isaiah 14 and verse 3, it shall come to pass in the day that the Lord gives you rest from your sorrow and from your fear and the hard bondage in which you were made to serve, that you will take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say, how the oppressor has ceased. That day is coming. The golden city ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the acceptor of the rulers. He who struck the people in wrath with a continual stroke, he who ruled the nations in anger is persecuted and no one hinders. Now, really, this is speaking about the devil and about his hold on mankind and how he has ruled man. Verse 12, how you were fallen, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you were cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. He has weakened the nations. The vain philosophies of men have weakened the nations. The abolition of the law of God has weakened the nations. Verse 17, who made the world as a wilderness and destroyed its cities, who did not open the house of his prisoners. Not necessarily physically destroyed, but it's a mess. Our world is a mess. And it all was summed up by Jesus Christ in John 8 and verse 44, speaking about mankind in general since the Garden of Eden. Now, that's what man has been subject to. Jesus Christ said, John 8, 44, you are of your father, the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. The world we live in today is saturated with a spirit of murder, and it's influenced by the god of this world, as you know. Paul said in Romans 1 and verse 28. There are a bunch of these scriptures that are kind of little synthesis of what has happened throughout history, right? And we're coming, as we know, at some point to a climax in these things, a climax in the history of mankind. We don't know exactly when it's going to happen, and I can guarantee you that just watching world events isn't going to make it happen for you. You've got to be close to God. You've got to be praying, studying, fasting, meditating. You've got to be, or else, you know, somebody brought up the point, you know, we've always been deceived. The whole world has always been deceived. You haven't seen it yet. You haven't seen anything yet. That's my conviction. We have seen a glimpse of it through this last 6 months of how people can be coerced to be complicit to government and how they can listen to all of this nonsense coming in over the airwaves of the news and actually believe it when they don't know that they're being played. They're being played. It's amazing. Christ said, you are your father, or pardon me, Romans 1:28, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind. Look, up just one of these philosophers that I've mentioned, Rousseau, for instance. This guy was an absolute wreck of a human being. He was smart. He was witty. He's probably fun at parties. But he's a nut. Never acknowledged. He had like 6 or 7 kids. Never acknowledged one of them. They all were sent off to orphanages after they were born. Being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, they are whisperers. Now, Jesus said in Mark 7 and verse 20, what comes out of a man, that defiles a man. That is, these ideas, these thoughts that are contrary to the law of God. What comes out of a man, that defiles a man, for from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, theft, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. Now, we've always known a man is not perfect. Man is held in check in society. Our nation has been kind of held in check. Other nations are held in check because they obey laws and that sort of thing. But this really is, there's always a seedier side of mankind, man's nature, and it's exposed in some men, and prisons fill up and they're filled with monsters and people that are absolute wrecks. But this is a description of the world that we live in. It's held captive by these false ideologies, or portions of them to some degree. A spirit of competition in which those who survive are the cunning, like nations. They survive on cunning. To them, the law, there is no law that needs to be obeyed. There are several nations that are powerful nations today that do not, they look at any kind of law, even international law, for instance, as an impediment to the goal of world domination. They want to be dominant. They want to be the top dog. And one of the ideas that came out of these philosophies that began to germinate in the 19th century was that the ends justify the means, or the means justify the ends. What is the word here? What is it? Anyway, the ends justify the means. So whatever it takes, in other words, to get the job done, we'll do it. And we have a number of people in the United States who believe that as well. Doesn't really matter what it takes, as long as we get in control. We will do whatever. It's scary. It is really scary to contemplate that from a political point of view, right and wrong doesn't matter anymore to some of these folks. I have more to say on that in a little bit. But Jesus, in his first coming, expanded the concept of law. And you know, as a member of the Church of God, for you, that law has a claim on your life. That it's not just the outward appearance of doing right, but you know, because of the Spirit of God, when you do wrong, right? And you realize that that law has a claim on you, as Christ explained. Now, Habakkuk chapter 2, can we find that in the Bible? Can you find Habakkuk 2? A little test here. Habakkuk 2, and verse 12, it says, "Woe to him who builds a town with bloodshed, who establishes a city by iniquity. Behold, it is not the Lord of hosts that the peoples labor to feed the fire, and the nations weary themselves in vain. The earth, though, here's the good news. The earth will be filled. It will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. So where are we going? This is brief. I know I've taken 40 minutes to explain to you where we have been, why we are where we are today. Where are we going? Where are we going? The last part of this verse shows you where we're going. It's good. It's hopeful. It's encouraging. And I think that if God's people need anything at this time, it's encouraging. Now, the ideas that have been espoused through man's philosophies, make no doubt about it, they have been defeated many times. They've been defeated like you cannot believe. Your parents, your grandparents helped defeat these false isms. Seems like it's a battle that even in our generation, we've had to fight against these ideals and these, I won't even call them ideals, we've had to fight against these isms through the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. They were beaten back. But it's like, it just keeps coming back to life. These things get resurrected over and over and over again. They weren't killed. And they're not going to be killed for a while. But I want you to know that every one of you are going to have a hand in killing off these philosophies forever. You know, what couldn't be done physically is going to be done mentally and spiritually. Some of it's going to be physical, but the powerful influences on mankind in the future won't be Mao, Stalin, Freud, or any of the world's great thinkers. It's going to be Jesus Christ, Moses, James, Peter, John, and you. That's what's going to bring about change. Habakkuk shows in the latter part of the prophecy that I just read, you know, there's always good news. And you look through all the prophecies and you find out, oh, there's doom and gloom. Yep. And then you find there's good news too. There's good news sprinkled throughout. Read the minor prophets. You're going to see, you know, the condemnation, stern condemnation, the judgment against Israel, Judah, Joseph, Jacob. You're going to see all of that through all those 12 books. But then sprinkled along, bing, 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 you're going to see as well the good news. It's just going to be sprinkled throughout. And I think that God did that on purpose, just my opinion. Just sprinkled out throughout all of those books, the good news, so that you're just not torn down by the fact that it's all going to be doom and gloom. It's not. It's a message of hope and peace. Isaiah chapter 11 is a wonderful prophecy, and we always read it during the feast, and we should. It shows that there are going to be so many significant changes that happen. And while Habakkuk says briefly that our cities, our nations are established by wrong values that really bring people down and bring mankind down, or the author of all of that is the devil, Jesus said. It says in Isaiah 11 and verse 6, we always like this for the little kids, right? When it was our kids that were little, we always loved this passage for our little children. We always love it now because of our little grandchildren who are so cute, and most of the time they're pretty innocent. Hello to all of you little grandchildren out there, whether you're ours or the Horchaks or the Gatlins or whoever is out there, we love you. And it's our hope. We don't know when these things will happen, but it's our hope that you'll experience this as a little kid. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat. The calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. That would be great. Now we'll see some of our progeny somewhere down the line have a hand in this. The cow and the bear shall graze. Their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. Instead of eating the ox, it's going to eat straw like the ox. That's going to be amazing. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and the weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. Throughout the government of God, it's going to be different. The earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. See, we see just a dramatic change in everything. Animal kind and humankind. Ezekiel chapter 38. Ezekiel 38. We'll also throw this into that at the end of the 1,000 years. Now, for 1,000 years, we're going to defeat, we're going to obliterate, we're going to get rid of these horrible ideas. But when Satan is loosed again, guess what? Same old playbook. There have been some great football coaches through history, right? Bear Bryant, Vince Lombardi, Don Shula. Great coaches always seem to have a system. They always seem to have a playbook. And they run the same stuff, maybe make a few modifications. They teach their teams the basics. One coach was interviewed and said, you coached in high school, you coached in junior college, you coached in college, and then you coached in the pros. And yet, your offense has never changed. He says, go back and look at my record. I won 80% of my games in high school, junior college, college, and now in the pros, similar results. You don't change a winning game. My playbook works. Well, so does the devil's when he's given a chance. In Ezekiel chapter 38, if you read these verses beginning in verse 10, it says, thus says the Lord God, on the day it shall come to pass that thoughts will arise in your mind and you will make an evil plan. It's after the 1,000 years. And you will say, I'll go up against a land of unwalled villages and I'll go to a peaceful people who dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls, having neither bars nor gates. You use all those wrong philosophies, dissolution, the abrogation of the law. You can skip over to Revelation in 20 and see what's going to happen when he's loosed for a little season. I don't want to spend too much time on that. That's the negative stuff. We're going to get rid of that too. And then it's going to be an eternity of all the good stuff, all the happy things. Amos chapter 9 and verse 13. Amos 9 and verse 13. We can talk about a lot of these things during the chat, a lot of the things. I think it's kind of therapeutic a little bit. Get some things off your chest. Speak your mind a little bit. We've been cloistered. We've been cut off from society. Now Terry's working from home. She goes out a little bit. She's busy since I can do a lot of the things that, for the family. Well, we're the family, she and I. I can do some things, but I've seen some of you out there too, but I go out into the store and the interaction is nutty. I hate it, to be honest with you. It's therapy for me right now to talk about this. Go into any stupid place. I have to wear this dumb mask, which I know is not doing any good at all. It's like erecting a chain link fence in my backyard to keep the mosquitoes out. And that's about as good as it is. That's about as helpful. And then you got these people who, wear their masks or their face coverings. It's like they're a mask bandit. They're not covering the nose. You've seen that? Yeah. You've seen the people. Today we're coming to services. Some guy's proudly walking down the street in his mask in 100-degree weather. A virus is not going to, I don't even care if it's a coronavirus. It's not going to survive in this air. It's killed by the ultraviolet light. And yet, this guy proudly wearing a mask. My therapy session. But I'm compliant because I have to go buy stuff. But the craziest thing is the restaurants have opened, so you got to wear a mask into the stupid restaurant, and then there are people sitting in having lunch, and they don't have to wear masks. Does that make any sense to anybody?
Oh, we must be compliant with the government. We can't disobey.
Oh, boy. Don't get me started. All right. Amos 9 and verse 13. Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper and the treader of grapes with him who sows seed. The curse of the Garden of Eden is going to be removed. Boom. God removes that. And there's going to be so much, so abundant, it's going to be difficult to harvest it all. You're not going to be able to get it all in before you have to even plant. There's so much of it. The mountains shall drip with sweet wine, and all the hills shall flow with it. I will bring back the captives of my people Israel, and they shall build the waste cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink wine from them. They shall also make gardens and eat fruit from them. That's going to be great. There's nothing wrong with wine. In fact, the other day, Terry informed me, we have a little wine rack. I don't know how many bottles it holds. How many does it hold? 20, 30, whatever? 40, maybe. Terry looked at the wine rack and she said, "We are running dangerously low on wine." I said, "Atta girl." Dangerously low. She was serious. People will be unafraid in the cities of the world tomorrow. They're going to be productive and they're going to be happy. Not like today. I mean, going out into society today, we have been so cut off from each other that I think that the mental illness that is accrued from all of this shutdown and lockdown and wearing masks nonsense has done a lot more harm than the silly virus has done. Now, we have rehearsed and read about this incredible increase in production for many years, and this kind of prosperity is something that we really look forward to, but I've got a little bit of news for you. I was going to ask you to turn. I think I will. We've got a little time. Micah chapter 4 and verse 1. Micah chapter 4 and verse 1. Prosperity. No one's going to run dangerously low of wine again. That won't happen. We'll all be like Joe Dwornick. Or they'll all be, because we'll be spirit. Well, only in this way will they be like Joe Dwornick and making their own wine. All the other ways, they don't want to be like Joe Dwornick. I was just kidding. Just kidding. Joe actually won a silver medal with his Cabernet Sauvignon. We kind of joke about it, but he actually produced some really good wine. In fact, into that wine rack, we had the family over a couple of years ago, and I think James is saying, "Dad, which of these bottles you want me to open?" I said, "Just pick one out." He went in, and Joe had given me a bottle of his Cabernet, and I didn't know what it was. I mean, I don't really have very expensive wines, by the way, so you should all chip in and buy me an expensive couple of bottles. But anyway, but James poured that, and I said, "Wow, that's good. What is it?" And he says, "It was this." And I looked at it. That's Joe's wine. I was amazed. So it was good. That was the one that you won a silver medal with. I mean, he submitted it, and he won a silver medal. Start cranking out some more of that stuff, will you? That's okay. Micah chapter 4 and verse 1. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains. That's just speaking about government. Mountain is symbol for government. This shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow to it. Many nations shall come and say, "Come and let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob." Won't that be refreshing? Instead of people marching to the courthouse, the federal courthouse in Portland, Oregon, to burn it down, they'll be going to learn of God's ways. You know, instead of being anarchists and disobedient to law, they're going to want, hey, this is what brings about prosperity. This is what helps out. For out of Zion the law shall go forth, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many peoples and rebuke strong nations afar off. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. The millennial rule of Jesus Christ and all the abundance that is going to come and all of the wealth is going to mean nothing without the addition of the thoughts and the ideas of God to change the behavior of men. God can supernaturally change the nature of animals, but man has to be taught the law. And that's where all of us come in. Be a student of the law now. Learn the law. Learn, put it into practice in your own life. Understand it so that when this future comes, you'll be one of those teachers. And then I'll bet several generations in, one of the curiosities of the millennium is going to be of generations that rise up and learn from the get-go. You know, children that are born during that time and generation. How? They'll look back. They'll be taught the history of mankind. How could that have been tolerated? I can just imagine the young, innocent minds that'll wonder, how? How could that have happened? I think that there will be the technology to show them the filmography or whatever, to transport them back somehow so that they can see what happened as a lesson for them. And they'll wonder, how did man come to think that God was dead, Grandpa? How did he ever come up with that nutty idea? How did he come up with this strange thinking, Grandma? How did men and women, why did they treat each other that way? And as you watch the news of the day, the world news today, and you see the violent protests against the founding of our nation, which God allowed, I want to warn you of a misleading philosophy of man which is designed to throw you off track. One final false ism, okay? And that is the falsehood that is used to argue against you who believe in law. And it's called, it was named by a psychologist in the turning point of the 20th century by the name of James. And he called it moral equivalence. Now, what is moral equivalence? Now, I know that I have some granddaughters that are listening in, so I'm going to give you an example of moral equivalence that you have probably either been a part of or you have seen on the playground at school. You have two children fighting on the playground, and they're fighting for however long. These two kids are scrapping it. Could be girls, could be boys. The teacher comes, breaks up the fight. And typically what teachers do nowadays is both kids are punished. That is an example of moral equivalency. But wait a minute. Most reasonable people realize that there's probably a party there that is guilty, and the other one may have just been protecting themselves and fighting back. One of them may have been the school bully that picks on everybody, and the other one is just an innocent child, but like at some point in my children's lives, I told them if they were being picked on, if they didn't fight back, then Dad was going to have to beat them when they got home. I did. Hey, I'm sorry. But nobody picked on them after that. After they defended themselves. So moral equivalency is assigning blame to both. Take almost any example today. And I think, you know, unfortunately, years ago in the church, well, both sides are wrong. Really? Not always. Now, maybe sometimes both sides are wrong, but it's by degrees. Be careful of moral equivalency, because that is the progressive thought that argues that democracy and capitalism and our nation is just as bad as other nations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that both sides is wrong. When one side is absent of law, then that's the guilty side. Revelation 18 and verse 21. Okay, we're moving to a close here. All right, just want to let you know. Revelation 18 and verse 21. And I was asked this question, so I wanted to include it in a sermon. I was asked this question not long ago, but Revelation 18 and verse 21, it says, "Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, 'Thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found anymore. The sound of harpists, musicians, flutists, and trumpeters shall not be heard in you anymore. No craftsman of any craft shall be found in you anymore. And the sound of a millstone shall not be heard in you anymore. The light of a lamp shall not shine in you anymore. And the voice of the bridegroom and the bride shall not be heard in you anymore. For your merchants were the great men of the earth. For by your sorcery all nations were deceived.'" The question was, there's Rome, there's Babylon. What does it all mean? Babylon is a system of thought that was established after the flood. It was an anti-God system, going back to Nimrod. And that idea has been around for thousands of years. And those ideas are going to spring up. The anti, you know, you could call it, I guess God could have called it a number of things, but it is labeled Babylon the Great because it was the first great false system after the flood to develop, to where God had to preserve mankind by confusing all the languages. It's going to make a rise again. It's going to be defeated. It's going to be killed eventually. But it has been responsible, the ideas, and you could throw all of these isms into that whole framework of Babylon and its falsehood. You really could. And in it are the deaths of hundreds and hundreds of millions of people, and they'll only be destroyed by the return of Jesus Christ. They're going to be replaced by the institution of law and individual freedom and the law of God. And these ideas are going to replace for 1,000 years, and then eventually for all eternity, they'll all be exterminated, and we're only going to have the good. And as Mr. Armstrong liked to say, in the end, we win.